I said the right thing to hang me, but maybe I'd have a chance to make an 18-minute gap. There'd be an opportunity there. I'm Jim Farrell, and this is the beginning of the session on the moral ecology of everyday life. And I need to ask if anybody needs a sound enhancement system. No? Okay, well, I'll try to talk loud then, which is its own kind of sound enhancement system. I'm a college teacher, which means that I get paid to have conversations with students, conversations with other academics, conversations with all sorts of people, living and dead, whose books I read. Today, I'd like to invite you into my conversational circle by telling you about some things I've learned in my conversations with a whole variety of people, and then ask you to tell me some things that I can pass on after this. The people that I've listened to that I'm particularly going to be talking about this afternoon are Robert Bella, David Orr, Barbara Kingsolver, Alan Derning, and Wendell Berry. They've helped me think about what Bella calls the moral ecology of everyday life. And I think if we listen carefully to these conversations, we'll hear the sacred somewhere. Each of us will have to decide exactly where. I'm going to start what is going to be a kind of a lecture, but I need to let you know in advance that I never lecture in my classes at St. Olaf. But that's because I've assigned them 200 pages of stuff to read, and I can depend on them to have done the reading and be ready to talk about it. And since you haven't had the reading assignment, you have to put up with a little bit of talking. But you should know that since I never lecture at St. Olaf, there is no train of thought here, that you may feel free to interrupt me at any time, because I won't get lost, because I'm already pretty well confused. Each year in May, I participate in a ritual called college graduation. We did this year on May 23rd. I put on my gown, put on my hat, and I march in as much pomp and circumstance as I can muster in a peculiar rite of passage for about 700 young people. We call it commencement because it marks ritually the beginning of their lives as competent, compassionate adults in service to their communities. As I sit and watch them cross the stage to get their degrees, each and every one of them, one at a time, 700 people, their names mispronounced by the dean, I am always, except for the Johnsons and the Petersons, whom he always gets right.
Just the Scandinavian names are pronounced
right. The Scandinavian names are done pretty well. But I'm always filled with questions about education and about the society that shapes education for these students and for us. St. Olaf students know a lot that they didn't know 4 years earlier, but is it enough? They have all passed a history course, a literature class, a philosophy credit. They have finished the religion requirement, and they've encountered science and mathematics. They know something about the arts and speech. They have been introduced to two social sciences and a couple of physical activities. They have specialized in a major. They know a lot, but do they know enough? A lot of this depends on the answer to a question that Wendell Berry poses in one of his books of essays, the title of which is, What Are People For? What are people for? What do you think? The book of Genesis gives us one answer to that question. God creates the earth. She bestows it as a gift. She looks at it and she sees that it is very good. This is, as Dan McGuire once said, the most radical statement in the Bible. The earth is very good. The creation is good. And if we screw it up, it's not God's fault. It's ours. Another radical statement appears in the very same story. Among the animals of creation are Adam and Eve. God creates Adam and Eve in her own image. And then she tells them, among other things, to be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth and have dominion over it. The radical statement is not the part about being fruitful and multiplying. Most animals will do that without much instruction at all. The radical part is what follows: replenish the earth. This sometimes gets missed in all the language of subduing the earth and having dominion over it, but it comes first. In fact, it tells us what the dominion must be like. People must have a relationship with the earth that fills it up again, that makes it whole, that makes it healthy, that makes it holy, that keeps it, as God said, very good. This simple sentence is an invitation to Adam and Eve and to you and me to take part in the ongoing gift of God's creation, to be co-creators with God. Creation wasn't done on the sixth day. And God rested on the seventh day, not because the work was done, but because it wasn't. There was still more work to do. The Sabbath was not so much for God, I think, who probably wasn't particularly tired, even having created a universe, but for God's co-creators, for people who needed time to think about how to respond to the gift of creation by replenishing the earth. Have we taught our students this? To some extent, yes. Environmental studies programs are growing quickly at colleges, and the younger generation is much more ecologically conscious than we were at their age. They know about the dangers of global warming and ozone thinning and toxic waste and deforestation and endangered species. They know, as Andrew Shapiro shows in a brilliant little book called We're Number One, which I would recommend that one to all of you too. And as you see in that Outland cartoon that I gave you, that the United States is first in the world in greenhouse gas emissions and first in contributing to acid rain, first in air pollutants per capita, first in use of fresh water resources, first in forest depletion, first in paper consumption per capita, first in garbage per capita, first in hazardous waste per capita, first in nuclear reactors and first in nuclear testing, first in gasoline consumption per capita, first in oil imports, and first in oil spills affecting our shores, first in TVs per capita, and first in cars per capita, and first in use of cars instead of public transportation. We're number one in all of those things. And in the last, in cars, I should remind you, because this is 1993, that 100 years ago this year, there were no cars in the United States. 1893 was the year in which the first gasoline-powered car appeared. And now we live in a country where a life without cars is almost unthinkable. We've created a car culture in which fossil fuel-burning, carbon dioxide-emitting automobiles are a virtual necessity. We know all these things, and our students know most of them. But the greenhouse effect has little or no effect on the way we live our lives, in large part, I think, because we have only educated above the neck, and then only in abstractions, all of which those were. All of those are more or less abstractions to us, in part because mere knowledge is never enough. David Orr's book, Ecological Literacy, which I passed around there, helps a lot to see why conventional education is not enough for the challenges we face these days. He suggests, for example, that the medium of ecological literacy has contradicted the message. We teach environmental studies, and we teach them about ecological literacy in institutions which, for the most part, operate according to the ecological illiteracy of American culture, promoting short-term efficiency and convenience over long-term environmental benefits. At St. Olaf, most of our students have not the slightest idea about the sources of the resources that they use every day. St. Olaf, therefore, undertook a study of our resource flows in a project called The College and the Biosphere, which is mentioned very briefly in David Orr's book, because he was the one that suggested it to us. And when we did this, we found, for example, that the average molecule of food consumed at St. Olaf College travels 1,500 miles before it makes it to our mouths. We found, for example, that the apple juice that we drink at St. Olaf College came from West Germany, even though there are apple orchards in our county. And we have tried to begin to correct these sort of, what I would call the problem of invisible complexity of the institution of St. Olaf by paying attention to our resource flows and seeing if there are ways in which we can be more ecologically responsible than we have in the past. St. Olaf owns farmland around the college, and we have allowed it for years to be farmed in the ways that farmland is farmed all over the Midwest. We haven't paid any attention to it at all. We've taken the income, and that's it. We are now going to turn some of that back into sustainable farming techniques. St. Olaf is in an area where wetlands have been drained, and we own some of the land that has been drained, and we are now restoring wetlands in the area. But until very, very recently, we've operated in terms of ecological illiteracy, and for the most part, our students still don't know about the things that the college is doing. Such patterns of resource use are a standard operating procedure in American culture. They are part of what Robert Bella calls the problem of invisible complexity, in which the consequences of our actions are hidden from us by ideas and institutions that keep us focused on our lives as individuals rather than on our lives as members of communities, both social and ecological. And ignorance of these patterns makes us good citizens of what Barbara Kingsolver calls the nation in love with forgetting. The nation in love with forgetting, wonderful phrase. It comes from her novel, beautiful and provocative novel called Animal Dreams. And in this novel, she shows a high school biology teacher who does something different. Cody Nalin is the name of the teacher, and she says of her class, "What did I expect? They were teenagers. I knew that, but I still screamed at them because the Black Mountain mine was poisoning their mother's milk, and all they cared about was sex and a passing grade. I had rational intentions," she says. "I talked about evapotranspiration and rainforests and oxygen in the biosphere, how everything was connected. The last virgin timber cleared and milled to make way for a continent of landfills choking on old newspapers. It was a poetic lecture. Marta made the mistake of asking me how much of this poetry was going to be on the test." I glowered. "Your life is the test. If you flunk this one, you die." Cody began then to put the abstractions like evapotranspiration, into personal terms, telling the class, for example, about stonewashed jeans. "You know how they make those? They wash them in a big machine with this special kind of gravel they get out of volcanic mountains. The prettiest mountains you ever saw in your life, but they're fragile, like a big pile of sugar. Levi Strauss or whoever goes in there with bulldozers and chainsaws and cuts down the trees and rips the mountainside to hell so that all of us lucky Americans can wear jeans that look like somebody threw them in the garbage before we get them." And she continued, "Think about the gas you put in a car, the real cost, not just pumping it out of the ground and refining it and shipping it, but also cleaning up the oil spills and all that junk that goes into the air when it gets burned. That's part of what it costs, but you're not paying it. Gas ought to be $20 a gallon, so you're getting a real good deal. But soon the bill comes due, and we pay it or we eat dirt, the ultimate master charge." I do something similar to what Cody Nalin does in my class in American Ecological History. It's a course that traces the ecological revolutions of the last 5 centuries, from the time that Columbus got here, but really starting with the English in New England. Really, for any of you interested in ecological history, a wonderful book is Changes in the Land by William Cronin, sort of detailing the time when the English, actually even from the time that they are off the shore of New England, they see the pine trees. These trees have been just environment for the Indians, but to the English, these are masts. And they've already got them commodified before they even hit the shore. And the whole system of private property comes in. And you see this Native American system and this English system just sort of passing by each other because they don't know the language of each other's things. And then you see the kinds of ecological impact that the English have on the environment in New England. But the history that we teach, the history of that 500 years, the history even of the time that the English came is alive and well today because we think in ideas, in institutions, and we are embodiments of American ecological history. We live in a world shaped by American ecological history. And because that's true, because we are that embodiment of history, we conclude the course by writing an environmental impact statement on ourselves. To counter the consumer forgetfulness and the problem of invisible complexity that are part of our historical heritage, we examine the ways that we are complicit with ideas and institutions in American history that have either raped or replenished the earth. So I asked them to look at one day in their lives at St. Olaf College and simply report on everything they do and what's the ecological impact of it. So when you take a shower, where does the water come from? Where does the heat for the shower come from? Where do the soaps and shampoos come from? Where does the plastic come from that you carry the soaps and the shampoos to the shower in? It gets very tiresome after a while because they find out just how complex their lives are. Every bit of it is complexified in that way. This year, one of the environmental impact statements began, quote, "I believe that given today's society, it is impossible for an American to have a positive impact on the environment." This is not a very positive statement, but I do think it's true. What he means is that the ideological and institutional infrastructure of this country virtually guarantees that a normal, good American will live a life that is neither just nor sustainable. It is not just because it is not possible for all people on earth to live this way. and it is not sustainable because we are depleting resources at a rate that cannot last. Since 1940, notes Alan Durning in the book that I passed around there, How Much is Enough, Americans alone have used up as large a share of the Earth's mineral resources as did all people before them combined since 1940. We are stealing the gift of creation from our children and our grandchildren because we are not replenishing the Earth. And we are not replenishing the Earth in part because we are not replenishing the social institutions and community resources that could give us the satisfactions that we now seek in consumption. We have created what David Orr calls social traps, situations in which people are drawn into individually rational behavior that is destructive to the planet. The suburbs where I live are such a social trap. Because I live there and because I worship in Minneapolis, I quite rationally drive to church every Sunday. Without thinking about the ways in which my rational choice to go to church on Sunday has been channeled by government policy of the last 30 or 40 years, and social beliefs and behavior about the importance of individual choice in American culture. We have a culture that believes that I ought to have the choice where I worship and that I ought to be able to use as many fossil fuels as I want, if I can afford them, to get there. I drive to church without thinking. To some extent, I work without thinking, and I eat without thinking, and I am entertained without thinking in my life. Thinking in this sort of complex sense. I'm not absolutely absent-minded all the time, but thinking in this complex sense, I just don't think about these things most of the time. I take them for granted. In many ways, my life is unthinkable. In the next few days, however, I'd like to invite you to prepare an environmental impact statement for yourself. And I'd like to think about my everyday life to see if we can begin to see the problem of invisible complexity, the social traps that structure the habits of our hearts and lives. I'd like to figure out why good people like me do evil to people and to the earth. To do this, I will try to see myself and people like me as part of resource flows of food, water, energy, materials, and waste. I want to notice how Americans notice nature, why it is, for example, at a place like Holden Village, at particular places we stand and take pictures. That's all socially constructed. We don't individually decide what's a good picture spot. We have social conventions that tell us what's a good picture, and so the nature that we see here at Holden is filtered through a kind of social conventions. Anyway, I want to notice how we notice nature. I want to notice where and when we notice nature. On the average, Americans spend only 2% of their lives outside. 98% of our lives is spent inside buildings like this or cars. I would like to take an inventory of all the electrical appliances in my house and calculate the environmental costs of their use. I'm not going to actually do all this in this week, but these are things that I have in mind. I'd like to figure out about the ecosystem that is my lawn. I noticed that the lawns were being mowed out here today, and with one of the most polluting vehicles on the face of the earth, a gas lawnmower. To run a gas lawnmower for an hour, use the same amount of fossil fuels as you do to drive a car 50 miles. I need to think about what I waste and where it goes. I need to think about my two children, who, if they are average Americans, will consume 80 times more resources than a child in India. We think that India has a population problem, but they would have to have 160 children apiece to use as many resources as our families do. I will look for the problem of invisible complexity, the consumer forgetfulness, the social traps, to see if my life is sustainable. I want to understand why I act the way I do, why, in short, I act as an American. In doing this, I'd like to use the concept of moral ecology as a framework. According to Habits of the Heart, moral ecology is, quote, the web of moral understandings and commitments that tie people together in community. Robert Penn Warren beautifully expresses the idea of a web of moral ecology in the central image of his novel, All the King's Men. Cass Mastron, who's one of the characters in the novel, lived for a few years, and in that time he learned that the world is like an enormous spider web, and if you touch it, however lightly, at any point, the vibration ripples to the remotest perimeter, and the drowsy spider feels the tingle and is drowsy no more, but springs out to fling the gossamer coils about you who have touched the web, and inject the black numbing poison under your hide. It does not matter whether or not you meant to touch the web of things. Your happy foot or gay wing may have brushed it ever so lightly, but what happens always happens, and there is the spider, bearded black and with his great faceted eyes glittering in the sun like God's eye and the fangs dripping. The word web, which Belloc uses and which Penn Warren uses in that image, comes from a root meaning to weave, as do the words complexity and complicity. They come from the Latin complectere, to weave. And they suggest that we are complicit in the complexities of our culture, including what Robert Bella and his collaborators call the problem of invisible complexity. Most of the time, we think we're only complicit in what we intend. We think that we're only guilty if we intended to do evil. But the idea of invisible complexity or moral ecology suggests that we are complicit when we are involved in institutions that do evil, and we need to be changing those institutions. The problem of invisible complexity consists of the ideological and institutional infrastructure that frames beliefs and behaviors of people in a particular culture. These are the cultural lenses that frame what we see when we see something. Each and every morning, for example, I have a cup of coffee, and I see it when I see it through my blurry eyes as 8 ounces of a black beverage that will help me wake up. But if I saw it in all its complexity, I would see that in drinking my cup of coffee, I am complicit with cultural and ecological patterns that I would, for my peace of mind, probably prefer to keep out of sight and out of mind. For example, and here follows a list of some of what you might call the problem of invisible complexity of a cup of coffee. Coffee grows on bushes in tropical highlands. Coffee is hard on the land. Land that is planted in coffee is not planted in crops that feed people. The people who harvest my coffee are exposed to pesticides that are illegal in the United States. The people who harvest my coffee are often unjustly exploited by landowners in their own countries. Landowners in foreign countries often control the government, which they run for their own profit. The landowners in foreign countries are often controlled by the corporations in my country. Corporations are social constructions that give business people limited liability so that they can amass enough capital to pursue their business. Corporations are chartered by the states in the United States because they are supposed to be performing a public good. This is a convention that began in the 1830s or so. But in the last century, they have increasingly come to be understood as part of private enterprise. And that understanding that we have of public and private is very important to the moral ecology of everyday life, because most of the time we think that we're only responsible for our private lives and not our public lives. Corporation laws are among the laws that governments like mine enact to promote and regulate the sale of commodities. When I drink my coffee, I usually do not see it as part of public policy. The corporations which provide the coffee to me, that can it and put it on the shelves of the supermarket, pay only for coffee beans. The processing of coffee, which is the most profitable part of the process, is usually done in the United States. The idea of profit, which is an essential element of the American economy, we assume that corporations exist to make profits and not for any other purposes. I buy my coffee at a supermarket, which is a dense fact or a problem of invisible complexity in itself. Supermarkets are wonderful sort of cultural institutions to try to unpack with students. You can do every discipline that's done in a college in studying supermarkets. And I often do that. I had a debate with somebody at school once who was a Dante scholar and said everybody ought to know Dante, that it was really important to do that. And so I, just for the fun of it, said, let's have a debate. You present the case for knowing Dante. I'll present the case for knowing supermarkets. So it was a debate, Dante versus the supermarket. But anyway, the supermarket is a fine symbol of a market economy, which says essentially that it will meet the needs and the wants of people with money. If I want my coffee in the morning, I must find work which pays money. The supermarket is also, with the shopping mall, one of the institutions which houses one of America's main cultural activities, shopping. Americans spend an extraordinary amount of time shopping. I brew my coffee with tap water that I take for granted because I am a citizen of the United States. In fact, people in the United States are so privileged that they drink more soft drinks than water. We take the water so much for granted that we now buy more bottled soft drinks than we drink water. For me, coffee is an everyday activity, but in fact, coffee is not essential for life. There are times when I'm not convinced that that last statement is true, that when I wake up in the morning, I believe it's essential for life. But if I look at it in the broader sense, sort of later in the day, then I can say that it's not essential for life. It's a luxury. But I am so privileged that I never recognize that fact. My coffee connects me to the drug culture in the United States. I am part of a legal drug culture because this society has decided that stimulants like coffee are acceptable because they enhance my efficiency at work. If I drink coffee at work, which I do, I will do it as part of a coffee break, a term that is used whether or not a person drinks coffee. The coffee break is a social session that relieves people from the tedium and alienation of work that we have socially constructed in the United States. These are all ways that you might unpack coffee. I'm sure that there are 100 other things that you might say about coffee and the understand the complexity of coffee, but that's sort of a beginning of the way that we can begin to look at things in our everyday lives and see the ways that we're connected across countries. As you can see, the ideas and institutions that structure my cup of coffee are inherently ecological because they are a web of relationships. They are moral because they are concerned with questions of the good life and questions of justice. The ideas and institutions of everyday life enact our relationships with one another more frequently and more persistently than we can meeting face to face. Institutions structure our lives in incredible ways. Ideas and institutions are the invisible complexity of our lives. We do not see them any more than we see air, but they structure our lives and relationships every minute of our lives. They are, as Robert Bella suggests, the habits of our hearts that can make or break what he calls in his second book on this theme, The Good Society. I'll bring that, I have that up here at the Village with me. It's another wonderful book that I'd like to just pass around and let people get a look at. But these ideas and institutions are not the only possible ones, and I'd like to consider some alternatives in the course of this week. What virtues in our lives would produce actions that were harmonious in a larger commonwealth? These are the kinds of conditions for a kind of sustainable moral ecology that David Orr, Alan Derning, or Wendell Berry talk about. What virtues in our lives would produce actions that were harmonious in a larger commonwealth? And what sort of commonwealths, what sort of governmental policies must we create in order to encourage the harmonious action that we expect from individuals if we want people to get along together, if we want them to pursue a particular set of ends together, if we want them, for example, to consume less? How might we structure life for them so that that could happen? Right now, what we mainly do with institutions is to structure things so that individuals can do what they want. But how might we structure things so that we could together do things that we, in a way, collectively want, but we don't have to do in a system of choice like we have now? Perhaps we could learn from the Amish and other so-called backward peoples who have shaped a culture that preserves the virtues of humility, simplicity, moderation, prudence, frugality, hard work, neighborliness, and family stability. Perhaps we could relearn a religion of relatedness. I'm real interested in the fact that both ecology and religion have as their core a sense of relatedness, that the two terms are very much the same, at least in their roots. Here are some questions that we might consider in the next few days and in the time that we have left this afternoon. What's the good life? In America, the good life commonly means the affluent life. But what's good about it, taking the good very seriously? What's good about our lives? Is there anything better than the good life? This is a question we might consider. When I looked up the good life in my dictionary, there are two definitions. One of them is a life lived according to the moral and religious laws of one's culture, which I thought was an interesting definition. And the second is the more conventional one, a life abounding in material comforts and luxuries. And as I looked at them, I thought, are these definitions a contradiction in terms? Does definition one contradict definition two? In many ways, I think they do. Is religion in America, then, inherently countercultural? That's a question that we might ask. A second kind of broad question we might ask is, why do we act the way we do? Why do we act like Americans? How do we act as Christians? What's the difference and why? Reinhold Niebuhr once said that the church does not seem to realize how unethical a conventionally respectable life may be. What did he mean by that? A third question that we could ask in the course of the week is, what are the ecological consequences of our actions? What are the relationships of human organisms, us, with our environment, both social and natural? The fourth one I think is real important is, how do our actions create or attenuate communities? How do we make community in our lives? A fifth, how do we create, or you can see that these are interrelated and I might have grouped them in any other arbitrary fashion. How do we create or preserve a morally coherent life? How can we complexify our lives so that we give an honest accounting of our activities? This is one of the main themes of David Orr. I found several copies there. It's called The Real Cost. It has a separate chapter, real short chapters, 3 or 4 pages on genes, automobiles, water, coffee, all kinds of things. What's the real cost of these things? And he goes back in the way that I did with coffee to sort of look at all of the things that present to us the things that we take for granted in our lives. So how could we give an honest accounting of our activities, both personal and structural? I don't intend to answer these questions in the course of the week. I'm going to be like Walt Whitman, who said, "You are asking me questions and I hear you. I answer that I cannot answer. You must find out for yourself." But while I cannot answer these questions, I think that maybe I can leave some clues. To a great extent, these clues will be in the form of stories, and I trust these will be stories that we'll tell back and forth. In his recent book, The Call of Stories, actually probably not so recent now, maybe about 5 years ago, a wonderful book though, The Call of Stories by Robert Coles. Coles is a psychologist at Harvard, and he teaches at both the Harvard Law School and the Harvard Medical School, as well as Harvard College. And he did his medical training under William Carlos Williams, the poet. And William Carlos Williams gave him this advice about being a doctor. Williams said that the job was extraordinarily simple and complex. You just listened to people tell you stories, and then you told a story about what their story meant to you. So you would listen to the story of the symptoms, and you would tell a story back about medication, about care, about changes in lifestyle. So it's just a matter of telling stories. I think in a way, college teaching is that way too. I tell some stories and then I listen to some stories and back and forth. And this is the way that we learn. So in these 5 days, I think we could do the same. You be the doctor, I'll tell you some stories. You tell me what they mean to you. The test will be in 10 or 20 years. Remember that our lives are the test. We need to replenish the earth. If we flunk this one, we die. And I'd like to stop by reading the poem that's on the flip side of the cartoon there, the Wendell Berry poem. I forgot to put the title on it. It's called Manifesto, The Mad Farmer Liberation Front. Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay. Want more of everything ready-made. Be afraid to know your neighbors and to die, and you will have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. So friends, every day do something that won't compute. Love the Lord, love the world. Work for nothing, take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government and embrace the flag. Hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Praise ignorance for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not live to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of the songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this satisfy a woman dissatisfied to bear a child? Will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Go with your love to the fields. Lie easy in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. swear allegiance to what is nighest your thought. As soon as the generals and the politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection. Replenish the earth. Practice resurrection. So that's what I have to say. Those are my stories. What do you think?
I wish I'd be here for the next 4 days. deeply challenging and deeply troubling. You observe that we have used more of the world's resources in the last 40 or 50 years than all mankind before. Is it true also that there are as many people alive today as have ever existed in history?
Yeah.
And this sort of Malthusian apocalypse that we're in the middle of is, it raises questions of sort of categorical imperatives. We can try to shape our own lives in a model that all men might follow, but if the United States, in fact, is the bellwether of the problem, if we're put in a very delicate and fortunate position of having the luxury to be able to seek to reform ourselves, and yet what the world lusts after, in India, China to a lesser extent, and Africa, is what we have, what we've been able to do. I lived for a year in a city in south central India that had a population of 350,000 and independence in 1947. Today it has a population of over 4 million. And to deal with terms and figures like that, it's quite easy to say overpopulation. And yet when you look at the face of each child that's on the street with his family, and that human being has a dignity, has a reason, a right to live also. And those populations would not be there if it weren't in fact for the side effects of much of what we have in fact experienced, the technologies, the pesticides, the crop research, the gamma globulin that can be given to deal with hepatitis. And I can look in my own circle of acquaintances and family and know the number of us who wouldn't be alive if it weren't for advances in medical research, or who would not be genetically protected against various diseases. In this invisible network of complexity, where do we say there is enough? The Amish model might in fact be an attractive one, but it is primitivist to an extent also. And is it possible that by not reversing but by extrapolating from the complexities and from the technologies, that we may in fact find ourselves out of the woods? I was at a briefing in Los Angeles a week ago by an endowment management group, and they had brought in an ambassador, a former U.S. ambassador to Syria, to comment on petro discoveries in Saudi Arabia. And it was a government industrial complex. The story was that there is enough oil in the new fields that have been discovered in Saudi Arabia to sustain the levels of consumption that we have for at least 300 more years, that the resources are extraordinarily vast, which doesn't, of course, deal with the pollution problem at the other end. But is it possible that through meta-technologies that we, in fact, can remediate much of the destruction of the current technologies?
Well, I think the answer to that is
resources, though, to remediate things. You know, you're still consuming more resources than you do that.
But there's praise ignorance for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed.
David Orr has a similar thing to that. David Orr says the only populations that have ever lived in a sustainable way with the earth couldn't read. Mm-hmm. And that it's reading populations and advanced populations that have managed to live in ways that are not sustainable.
Do you think it's ironic to deal with that in a classroom?
Pardon me?
I'm sitting here with a college professor and a college president. Is this the height of irony at all, you know, if you're going to talk about the invisible complexity of what you do? It's, are you suggesting that?
That ignorance is sort of the top of the line?
Yeah, top
no,
of the
I wouldn't.
Line.
I wouldn't suggest that. In fact, Orr wouldn't suggest that in his book either. I mean, the book is a way of trying to get people to think very carefully about the ways that our lives are structured. Orr would say that technology can do a great deal for us. And actually, there's a thing on the rack in there. Garbage magazine in there has on their cover a thing called Green Cars, which I have to read before I talk about cars on Thursday. But there's all kinds of research in cars, and I think the most promising right now is hydrogen cars. Mercedes-Benz actually has a car that runs on hydrogen, which is the most plentiful element in the world. And the byproduct of it is water vapor, which is not harmful. So it's possible that you could still have the kind of individual transportation that we have with a technological fix like that. Orr would say, though, that for the most part, we're not very happy with all of the things that we have. We're not very happy in communities, and that a lot of the technologies that we have are responsible for that. I would say that cars are responsible for a lot of the breakup of community in the United States, because they structure our lives so that we don't have any practical interdependence. Part of the thing I'll say on Thursday that you'll miss, but I'll say it now, is, for example, when I run low on sugar at home, I'm more likely to get in the car and drive to the store, which is a mile and a half away, than to go to my neighbor, because it's easy to do, because the car structures my life in such a way that that can happen.
Because you may not know your neighbor's name.
Something like 72% of the people in the United States don't know their neighbor's name. I do, and I actually could go get a cup. I could go get a cup of sugar, but I still generally don't. I mean, it's a very peculiar kind of thing. This just occurred to me the other day. I think from now on, I probably will go get the sugar over there. Say I'm trying to save, you know, X amount of gas.
Your car or your mother speaking though? You know, borrow things.
Well, actually, mothers have a certain kind of wisdom, and I think the Amish have do too. But anyway, Orr would say there's a lot that you can do with technology, and most of the people that I am reading are not in favor of doing away with technology or that sort of thing. They're very interested in paying attention to the effects of technology and asking people in advance to try to consider, what's the meaning of this technology? What will it do for us, and what will it do to us? But Orr would also say that we need to consider changes in character, that we have structured our lives in a way that gives us an extraordinary amount of freedom, and we're not finding a lot of satisfaction in it. That when you ask people what are the things that they really enjoy doing with their time, they talk about family and friends and social time, and doing constructive work with other people is something that's very satisfying to people. And yet we've structured our lives so that a lot of the work that we do is alienating and not very constructive altogether. And so we spend large amounts of our time doing things that don't give these kinds of satisfactions. And because we don't get those kinds of satisfactions, then we say, I'm in this for the money, and I'm going to take the money and buy satisfactions in terms of consumption, in terms of private time, in terms of vacations, or something like that. And so Orr would say, pay attention to the dissatisfactions that our affluence causes and try to scale back. Now, Durning has a similar kind of take on it, but a little bit different. Durning, in his book, pays much more attention to the whole world than Orr does. Durning says there are essentially three classes of people in the world. There are the affluent classes, largely in the United States and Western Europe. There's a sort of second world of sort of lesser developed countries, but still sufficiently developed countries. And there's third world, and that kind of terminology is not real useful, but sort of just take it for now. And he says that everybody in the world can live at that second level. There are enough resources to do that. And so if we could scale back to that, not scale back to third world conditions, and if third world people could scale up to that, with some of the trade-offs that you're suggesting, in a way, very difficult for us to lecture people about you know, not using resources in a rainforest, when a lot of the things that they're doing with that land are things that we want done anyway. Very hard for us to lecture in that way. So we need to be scaling back consumption so that third world countries can see that maybe they don't need to achieve this American standard of living. Anyway, those are some of the ways that I would think about that.
Another thought that I have on technology, which I thought a great deal about, is that we rely so much on it that we have created this myth, and most of us believe in it, that science will, in fact, or technology solve all of our problems. So we can go ahead and do what we really want to do. Maybe fearing that it will create another problem, or three or four, that we believe that science will always be able to bail us out. I think we must sober up on that myth,
or
begin to explore the realities.
Or I would say also that every scientific discovery has with it a sort of a certain amount of the increase in the amount of ignorance also. So he says, for example, in the 1930s, fluorocarbons were invented. Everybody thought, great, these are wonderful, you use them for refrigerants. So there was, I mean, that was a discovery, and it was a useful kind of discovery. But there was a certain amount of ignorance that went along with that, of what would this do with the ozone. And so we went through about 40 years of ignorance until we caught up with the other thing that there was to know about chlorofluorocarbons. And so Orr would say, actually there's a wonderful image about this in a utopian novel that I use in some of my classes, Woman on the Edge of Time by Marge Piercy. It has a sort of eco-feminist utopia way out in the future. And it's just a delightful read, and it's also great for getting people to consider social construction of reality issues. But anyway, there's this character from the present who's able to go to this future society, sort of through kind of time transportation or something like that. And she ends up there, and she's talking about drugs, and she says, well, you know, I'm taking these drugs, and it has these side effects. And the person in the future says, what are side effects? Side effects are only the things that the commercial people who are selling you something don't want you to think about. You know, we say, birth control pills have the side effects of these kinds of things on women. But they're all effects. But we structure them as effects and side effects because this thing is commercially profitable and this thing has to go along with it. And many of the side effects of things are invisible to us for a long time. They're the ignorance that's created with the knowledge that's also created. I'm real good at doing this with classes too. I can just kill a conversation like that.
Even just a little that we see here at Holden in terms of ecology and you know, conservation and ways in which they handle. I mean, that whole sort of thing is, you know, foreign to most of us.
Yes, I was on.
Yet it's a pretty, I'm sure, simplistic.
Yeah.
The garbologist.
I haven't been on Garbo yet, but I was on dish team today, and so I was scrubbing all the pots and pans, and that spinach stuff that we had for lunch today is very sticky. And there was an extraordinary amount of it just on the pans. I mean, if you sort of think about it, at a place that is as careful about the environment as Holden.
Split pea soup here, and
I'm just praying that we don't have that Wednesday for lunch.
It's amazing how much garbage there is, though. Isn't there?
At least one huge trash can.
Yeah. Even though they preach every single meal, you know, mm-hmm. to eat what's on your table and don't go get any more until you absolutely know that you need it.
What do your students do with a semester of this? It must be profoundly unsettling.
It is very unsettling.
Good education is.
Some of them get very, very angry at me. And just simply by the end, some of them by the end of the semester just shut down. They simply say, this is too much, this is too painful to think about all of these things, and I can't handle it. And I've worked over the years to try to give them more and more support in the course of the semester so that doesn't happen. For the most part, they get involved. I mean, I think this is another thing that Orr says, is that the education, the way that we mostly do it now is, you know, just here in the head, and if you pass the test, you're okay. But he says that's simply not going to do anymore for education. Education is going to have to be here in the heart. and it's going to have to always, the assumption of education is that it always eventuates in some action. If you haven't changed your behavior, you haven't learned anything. And so a lot of them get involved in the recycling stuff that does go on at school and things like that.
I would think side by side with some personal reformation that might also suggest new career opportunities for students at a time when they're seeing the precious few of the men out in as much as environmental technologies and environmentalism is one of the fastest growing commercial sectors also in our country.
Yeah, the in the American Ecological History class, probably half the students are environmental studies majors, and so they're already sort of thinking about those kinds of things. But our environmental studies program hasn't expanded so much that we can't staff it right now.
It's a problem that it's hard to make money off of conservation knowledge.
Yeah.
That's a problem utility companies have. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although there are...
They don't want your newspaper anymore, and they don't want your, you know, recyclables anymore. It costs more to recycle the stuff than they can get out of it.
But there are consulting firms that work with businesses, for example, now to cut back. Businesses are very, very, you know, getting more and more careful about what they use. And so conservation to them is very profitable, and there are consulting firms that work with businesses to help them reduce their resource flows. And there are also, businesses are now in a situation with the, where the, my wife is a director of risk management for a grocery wholesaler, which is part of the reason that I know so much about supermarkets. I get to read all of the trade magazines, Progressive Grocer and Supermarket News. Trade magazines, I must tell you, are the best ways to find out about anything in the world. My original research when I got out in graduate school, my dissertation was on death and dying. And I did a book called Inventing the American Way of Death, and it was on the period from 1850 to 1920. And I got to read Casket, Sunnyside, those were two funeral directors' journals in the 1870s. They've now merged, and one of the major trade journals now is called Casket and Sunnyside, which I found. The American Funeral Director, Park and Cemetery, Monument Builder, but my favorite is a magazine that premiered in 1892, The Embalmers Monthly. But you find out so much about death and dying and the ways that they see it and understand it and the ways that they're looking towards a kind of to be professionals in the same way that doctors or priests are, because they're trying to absorb parts of those two roles. And supermarket trade journals are just wonderful for telling you. I mean, they tell you that each issue of Progressive Grocer has a layout of a supermarket and tells you exactly why it's laid out in that way, why they want you to go buy the bakery first while you're still hungry, or the produce. Because when you pick up the produce, then you start to look for other things to go along with that in the meal. And the sort of the psychology of a supermarket is just incredible. If our psychology departments were half that good in academia, we'd be wonderful. But anyway, I started on that by way of getting at my wife, who's a director of risk management, which means it's her job to make sure that they don't lose money over insurance stuff. And one of her major roles now is to prevent losses on environmental things. Every time they buy a site for a grocery store, if it has the slightest bit of toxic waste on it, they have to clean up the entire thing. And it's very expensive for them to do that. And so she works a lot with companies like Waste Management Incorporated on doing environmental cleanup. And there's a great deal of profit to be made now in environmental cleanup, because there's so many toxic sites in this country because we didn't pay attention. Right up there, right.
But now you can buy pollutant gobbling microbes also, can't you? As one means of remediating petroleum spills, particularly.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to gouge out all of the dirt and transport it to the Indian reservation in Mexico. People in California have been one.
Actually, gouging is still the main way of dealing with toxic waste.
But in some cases, you can inject life forms and digest and neutralize the.
Some of which are the patented life forms. Some of them are out of biotechnology advances.
I mean, now that we've discovered that, 20 years down the road, maybe we'll discover some side effect that was bad.
Well,
you do a great horror movie of these microbes taking over the cars.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a serious question that you do need to sort of an environmental ethicists want is when a company wants to market a microbe like that, that they need to make, you know, an environmental impact statement and a kind of ethical impact statement on it. What will it do to us? What kinds of things will happen to us? Not just technically either, but also socially. And you know, what will the social repercussions of it be?
What do your students think about the Mall of America? Or is it the, is it ever misspelled M-A-U-L?
generally not. I guess I tend to get a kind of select group of students. I'm known as kind of a weird professor at St. Olaf, and I tend not to get the big spenders generally. Well, sometimes, like, you know, just by chance, somebody will take a class of mine because it's at the right hour. So my students are not real fond of the Mall of America generally. But, you know, in fact, one of the things that we're doing this coming year for all of the incoming first-year students, they're all going to the Mall of America during week one. And we're going to try to see if we can use liberal education to frame something as popular as that, to understand, you know, where does the Mall of America come from, and to do, in a way, some of this kind of historical context of consumption, and also some literary kinds of things in framing it for our students. I think that's wonderful. I mean, I think that's the way that we ought to visit the Mall of America, as kind of critical observers. I've been there a couple times every time that somebody comes to Minnesota now, you have to take them there. My mother and then I've been there on the two of the four busiest days of the Mall of America. The first time my wife was having something at the house on a Saturday, and I decided to take my kids because they really wanted to go. And that turned out to be a day on which there were 180,000 people there. And then my mother-in-law came over Thanksgiving, and the only time we could work it to go was the day after Thanksgiving.
Oh, yes.
And there, that day, I think, was about 170,000 people. And I've been there one other time at night. At night, it's really kind of interesting because there's an amusement park in the middle of it, and they shut down all the lights in there, and all you see is the lights of the rides.
Is that Snoopy Hill?
Pardon me?
Is that Snoopy Hill?
Yeah, it's called Camp Snoopy, yeah.
It's
been very, very successful, at least financially so far. I think in the long run that it won't be. I think in the long run it's too big. I mean, there's hardly anything in it that's unique. It's just more of all of the things that are in a normal
mall. But they're going to add to it, right? It isn't.
I don't know that they're going to add to it yet. There's a site near it in which they may put up another mall or some kind of extension to it.
Minneapolis will be mauled to death.
Well, there already are lots of. I mean, we do have the world's first indoor shopping mall, so we have a tradition of malls. The nice thing about the early malls in Minneapolis, though, was that they all were owned by the Dayton Hudson Corporation, mm-hmm. and Dayton's had its downtown store, and they structured their mall so they wouldn't compete with downtown. But now the Mall of America is not owned by Dayton's, and in fact, Dayton's, I don't think, even has a store there. And so we're getting, in a way, people who are less interested in the community and the long term of the community involved in other malls now, and I think that will hurt.
I want to go off in a totally quite different direction from that and just raise an issue when I could identify an area that it's hard for me to imagine what the alternative is like, and that is I come not only out of an era of high mobility, I feel as if it's been in many ways a gift not to live where I grew up. Simply. And yet, it seems to me that particularly in the domain of this where you're talking about community and connectedness and relatedness and all that sort of thing is much more tenuous. Have this kind of mobility driven by seeking work or not knowing your next door neighbors. You constantly have new next door neighbors. And I guess I just open it up. I don't have any view of how that's going to be particularly different, particularly if you look at the wider economy and dynamics, if anything else, more rapidly any one geographical locus loses jobs and some of the geographical locus have jobs. Just to take one element that drives that mobility. I just wonder, you read so many, told me so many good book titles in the last 20 minutes. I'm looking
yeah.
for another.
I think that the book, The Good Society, would be one that would help with that question. But it seems to me that we simply need to make communities, you know, more satisfying, more humanly satisfying. I'm also from a town that I'm happy to be from. And not living there anymore because it didn't seem to me to have the kind of liveliness that I want in a place where I live. But the things that I miss in a small town like the one that I came from are the things that are environmentally not harmful. To have a symphony, to have people playing music, to have people putting on performances of plays, those things are environmentally healthy. And David Orr, is it David Orr? No, Orr and Durning, and then there's another book that I will mention, Environmentalism and the Future of Progressive Politics by Robert Pelkey, talks about, you know, many of our satisfactions would come from types of economic activity that they call clean GNP, you know, where they need to come from cultural kinds of satisfactions rather than consuming kinds of satisfactions. And I might be willing to live in a small town that had those. In fact, Northfield, which is where St. Olaf is a town that I would live in because there are two colleges there and all the sorts of cultural activities that go along with the college. It's a wonderful place to live. It's ideal in many ways. And people do stay in Northfield for generations. But we need to create communities that are satisfying enough that we'll stay there over time and get to know each other and have a kind of sense of trust in each other. And that doesn't work very well when we're as mobile as we are now. And I think another thing that would happen, and one of the things that I take heart in is David Orr gave a lecture at St. Olaf several years ago, and he said, the optimistic thing is that necessity is colliding with